Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. Today on our show, we'll wade into the controversy over Proposition 57. That's a new ballot measure going before voters in November that asks whether certain nonviolent offenders should be given early parole from state prison. The issue is who would be eligible. Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims says it might even apply to certain sexual offenders, including those convicted of rape of an unconscious person. Governor Brown says no way, that's not how the law would be implemented. We'll hear from both the governor and Sheriff Mims about what's really going on. We'll also learn about the students majoring in a brand new field at Fresno State, Hmong Studies. And we'll talk about some new exhibits coming up at the Bakersfield Museum of Art, which is celebrating its 60th anniversary this year. Right now, though, we turn our attention to a story we first told you about last week in part two of our look at the broken system of Dentical. California does not have enough dentists willing to see millions of low-income patients enrolled in the state dental coverage program. Some patients with Dentical coverage wait years for treatment or even leave the country. That's even as the program is overwhelmed with millions more who have become eligible. Lawmakers have taken note, but are reluctant to open the state's pocketbook to solve the problem, as Capital Public Radio's Ben Bradford reports in the second of our series.
The basic problem is that 13 million patients are eligible for Dentical, but only a quarter of California's dentists sees even one of them a year. A stack of papers on the desk of Stockton dental surgeon Nicholas Vico can help explain why. It's a chart from a recent tricky surgery Vico performed on a Dentical patient.
So the total fee was about $4,000.
Correct.
But you're only, what does the second line mean?
What they will pay is $672.
In other words, Vico gets 17% of what he would from private insurance. These notoriously low rates are the main reasons dentists cite for not accepting Dentical. The other problem is the paperwork.
That chart looks more like a phone book than, a magazine, right?
It took that much correspondence with Dentical before he got paid.
There's a lot of work put in for those few patients, and I look at treating these patients more almost as a charity than I do a business thing. And there's only so much charity I can give.
Lawmakers in Sacramento have recognized this problem, but they're not solving it by opening the state checkbook. Democratic Assemblyman Jim Wood, a dentist himself, has authored legislation to reduce the paperwork. He spoke at a hearing in June.
If we could cut some of the red tape, I know a lot of my colleagues would gladly take Medi-Cal patients.
Wood acknowledges low pay remains a problem. To address that, Democratic lawmakers and the Brown administration are looking to the federal government. It's agreed to give Dentical a temporary infusion, $750 million over the next 5 years. That's a more than 10% bump to the program's budget.
I think it's going to be extremely helpful.
Dentical chief Alani Jackson says it could entice more dentists to see Dentical patients.
It gives us an opportunity to test how does getting additional monies for the services that you're already rendering impact provider participation.
But the funding comes with some limits. It would pay dentists higher rates, but only after they see a set number of patients. It's only to treat children. Some of the funding is restricted to certain counties with few dentists, and it's specifically for preventative medicine, to encourage more sealants and cleanings and teaching good brushing habits.
The whole theory behind it is let's prevent the disease before it starts, so I applaud that. But in identifying disease, you're going to get to the point where you can't prevent some of it, and some of it will have to be treated.
Dr. John Blake runs the nonprofit Children's Dental Health Clinic in Long Beach. It's one of the few places that provides specialty care to Dentical patients.
I just caution it because our program in our area has become a dumping ground.
He says the federal funding is good, but if the state wants to fix Dentical, it'll have to find the money. There is currently one plan to do that from what you might consider an unlikely source. It's not often Republicans support more funding for low-income entitlement programs, but that's exactly what's happening in California. Assembly Republican leader Chad Mace.
Let's not play a game that says that we're going to try to provide dental care for 13 million Californians when they can't actually access dental care. If you're going to have a program, let's make sure that it actually works.
Republican leaders in both Assembly and Senate favor adding $200 million state dollars a year to Dentical. They estimate that could at least pay dentists the national average for the most common procedures. That bill died in the Senate. During a budget discussion, Assemblyman Tony Thurman said they brought it up too late and it cost too much.
Pretty much at the end of the process, and what we've committed to is to having ongoing conversations about how we can do something around Dentical.
With a week left before the end of the session, that hasn't happened. California will have to rely on the temporary infusion of federal money and pared-down paperwork to allow Dentical patients access to the care they've been promised. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Bradford.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Last month, Governor Jerry Brown called Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims to talk about Prop 57, one of Brown's top priorities in November. It's a ballot measure going before voters that would allow certain nonviolent offenders early parole from California prisons. It turns out Sheriff Mims wasn't in the office when the governor called, so he left this voicemail where he talks about a mailer the sheriff endorsed that raised questions about the potential release of some prisoners under Prop 57, including some convicted of rape.
Hey, Margaret, I got that mailing on Prop 57 that you signed with the sheriff of Orange County and Larry Morris, Greg Totten. You enclosed a card of a guy that you said would be released under my proposition. I just want you to know that's completely false, and that makes that mailer extremely false, and I would even say malicious. So I hope if you're lending your names to things, you can have some decent due diligence so they don't purvey easily refutable facts. This guy was sentenced to 100 years. He's a registered sex offender on both accounts, would not be getting out. So that's the kind of scare tactics that I think are unbecoming of a public official and certainly will not build the kind of mutual respect and trust that we all need to do our jobs. So that's all I can say. Maybe I'll see you up at the sheriff's meeting. Thanks.
That voicemail didn't go over too well with Sheriff Mims, who stands firmly opposed to Prop 57. To hear more, we talked with her last Friday. Here's our conversation. Sheriff Mims, welcome.
Thank you for having me again.
A few weeks ago, Governor Brown left a voicemail for you. We just heard that message on our air. What was your reaction when you heard the governor's message initially?
Well, initially, I gave the governor a benefit of the doubt. I thought, you know, could we have made a mistake? So the first thing I did was send the voicemail to the campaign, No on 57, and ask to confirm that this guy was eligible for release should Prop 57 pass. And it was confirmed that he is, in fact, eligible. When confronted with this, the governor's response was, well, I'm going to put regulations in place to make sure that doesn't happen. The problem with that is regulations can come and go. If this passes, it will be law. And governors come and go. And so a next governor could even change regulations. So out of the abundance of caution, I double-checked it. The governor was wrong. This guy is eligible for early release. And that means that we're not safer because of it.
So a lot of this goes back to what is considered a violent or a nonviolent offense under current law and how Proposition 57 treats those instances. The governor is saying that if you're a sexual offender, that is a violent offense in his view. But you're saying that the law actually treats it differently in some cases.
Right. And his proposition would treat it different. So his proposition leaves open what is considered violent and nonviolent. So the reading of the measure is that the violent offenses would fall under a penal code, and that penal code is section 667.5, and it has a list of what violent offenses are. Unfortunately, many violent offenses aren't included in that penal code, and I'm talking about violent offenses such as rape by intoxication. So if somebody uses a date rape drug, or rape of an unconscious person, drive-by shootings, assaults with a deadly weapon, domestic violence involving trauma, lewd acts against a child under 14 or 15 years old, arson, failing to register as a sex offender, and that's only a few. Those are not included in the penal code definition of a violent felony. So those in custody right now, many second strikers would be eligible for release immediately if Prop 57 passes.
You made mention of the governor's intent to impose some new regulations after the fact, if voters were to approve this in November, that would, in his view, close those gaps. Your concern about that is what exactly again?
Well, the regulations can be changed. Governors are going to change. So I don't want to leave it up to a sitting governor to decide how this is applied. I want to make sure that we close any loopholes by not passing this law, because then the decisions are made by a non-elected board, the parole board, on who gets released and who doesn't. And I don't think that's right.
Sheriff Margaret Mims of Fresno County joins us now. You recently met with fellow sheriffs from across the state. What was the discussion like with regards to Proposition 57 as folks in your field are debating this?
There is no sheriff in the state that is supporting Prop 57. The discussion was, as an association, what position do we take? And the decision was to stay neutral on the proposition. And I will tell you, the governor and the state of California holds a lot of hammers over the heads of many counties, and including jail funding. So the opportunity to punish sheriffs for actually coming out against the measure could be detrimental. And so the association itself voted to stay neutral on the proposition. However, as individual sheriffs, we can take our own positions.
Now, the governor has been very active, not only with Proposition 57, but in recent years, pushing other elements of criminal justice reform, sentencing reform, things like that. How do you feel those are playing out from your perspective in Fresno County so far?
Well, from my perspective, our jobs are not getting any easier and our communities are not any safer. So realignment occurred in October of 2011. And what that did was make the county responsible for many inmates and supervision of inmates that formerly were the responsibility of the state. This all happened as a result of a lawsuit filed by state inmates that started in the early 90s. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court told the state of California, yes, you're overcrowded, and it's due to the lack of medical care, so you must reduce your capacity. Now, the Supreme Court did not tell the state how to do that. So, for instance, they could have reduced capacity in facilities by building more facilities. You know, our population in California has risen dramatically. And when your population increases, you're going to have a certain part of that population that's going to commit crimes. We have not kept up with our population. But the governor's decision was to realign inmates, which means they didn't open up the back doors. They closed the front doors. We're just not going to take people like we used to. They are now a county responsibility. So that was realignment. Then Prop 47 passed, and that took effect in November of 2014. Immediately, our crime rate started going up. What Prop 47 did was change many felonies into misdemeanors. People were not then going to get treatment because they had a misdemeanor rather than a felony. There was no incentive to get involved in treatment programs, and our crime rates started going up. Now Prop 57 comes along, and I think it's the time now is to say enough is enough. Overall, in the state of California, crime rates are increasing, including violent crimes, which is the first time that's happened in many, many years.
There's another issue that recently has been advanced to the governor's desk now, and it's this bill called AB 2792, and it would, in effect, allow criminal aliens in California to refuse interviews with ICE. Immigration and Custom Enforcement has been working, in the case of Fresno County, closely with you, Sheriff Mims, and the folks at the jail for some time now. This is going to the governor now. What effect would this have in real terms in what you're doing with the county jail right now when you have individuals that are in the country without papers and accused of crimes?
Yes, this is more than people just being in the country without papers. This is about people who get booked into the Fresno County Jail because they have committed additional crimes. So what we do now is we allow ICE in the jail to come and interview people not born in this country and they make a determination about their legality. And they are only targeting people who fall into the priority one and two out of the ICE priority enforcement plan, which actually has three categories. So they are targeting people charged with the worst types of crimes and have been multiple times deported. And I'm all supportive of that, you know, being into this country illegally and working hard, supporting yourself and your family is one thing. But when you come and then you commit crimes, that's pushing the envelope, and you should not be allowed to do that, and you should suffer the consequences. Now, the new law would change things and not allow local jurisdictions to communicate with ICE, which I believe is against federal law. The federal law says very clearly that you shall notify, you shall give information. So if the governor signs the bill, I look that there will be a legal challenge immediately.
Sheriff Mims, before we go, a couple of years ago, you were very outspoken on an issue that's of concern to a lot of mountain residents, and it was in regards to the new environmental protections for a couple of species, frogs that are native to the Sierra Nevada, and recently those frogs were granted essential habitat by the government in efforts to try to bring those species back. How concerned are you now about that issue and what it means for Fresno County? Do you see yourself as sheriff getting involved in that issue and potential enforcement and closing off areas?
Well, we're not going to be involved at all in closing off areas. I will tell you that right now. The negative impacts will include additional regulations on being able to manage our forests properly. We're already seeing the result of decades of improper management of our forest. Now, I will tell you that locally, the people working in the national forest, the national parks, know what need to be done. But unfortunately, they take the marching orders from Washington, D.C. So we've had overgrowth of trees when they should be thinned out, should have been thinned out for many, many years. So now we've gone through a drought. So now it's optimal timing for the beetle that's killing trees. So now we have over 60 million dead trees in California as a result of the beetle, as a result of not properly managing the forest. So it's just a domino effect over many years of inappropriate policies when it comes to properly managing our forests. Not to mention that the overgrowth of the trees take a lot of water that would normally percolate down into our aquifers, and we're not getting that as a result of not properly thinning the forest the way they should have been for decades.
Sheriff Margaret Mims, before we go, one last question about the governor. Any further conversations following that voicemail with Governor Brown about Prop 57 that you could share with us?
Well, as a result, we did personally talk. The governor did approach me at the state sheriff's meeting, and he said, "Margaret, you made me famous." And I said, "No, Governor, I think it's the other way around, but we're not going to agree on this issue, and that's why I'm adamantly opposed to Prop 57. Anything that makes my community less safe, I have a duty and a responsibility to fight, and I'm doing that."
Sheriff Margaret Mims of Fresno County joining us on Valley Edition. Sheriff Mims, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Prop 57 is just one of the issues going before voters in November. Here to continue our political discussion, we have with us in our studio live today, Fresno State political scientist Jeff Cummins. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
Prop 57 is one of those issues that is getting a lot of attention, starting to heat up as the ballot measures, and there's a lot of them going before voters in November, are starting to get attention. This issue about who gets potentially eligible for early release under Prop 57 is not going away. The governor says sexual offenders are not going to be eligible because the state is going to issue regulations after Prop 57 is approved by voters that will make it so. Is that an unusual practice for something like a law like this, or does it come into play because this is a ballot measure?
Well, I think there's a real question whether or not regulations can fix it. The problem that you have with ballot propositions, and this one is a combination of being of amending the Constitution and a state statute. And the way that California's initiative process is laid out is the only way to go back and change the language in a proposition is for voters to re-vote on it again. So in California and other states that have the initiative process, it's not this strict because, say, the legislature can go back and amend it. But California has one of the strictest provisions regarding how you can go back and change those propositions. So it's a matter of how you would interpret provisions of the measure. Does it make allowances for the legislature to come back and make changes or not? So if that's not in there, they can't necessarily easily change it.
Now, almost 40 years ago, Governor Brown was the one in his first stint in the office in Sacramento who signed the state's determinant sentencing law that set forth these mandatory sentences. Now the governor is going back. A lot of things have changed since then. In 1978, there were around 20,000 prisoners in state prison. Now it's over 128,000. An ongoing effort by Governor Brown to turn back some of the things he did in his first stint in Sacramento here with this and the other bills that he's supported and propositions he's supported in the past?
Yeah, he's been pretty clear about that he thinks he made a mistake in his first administration of signing into law these determinate sentencing. Of course, at the time, there was a real concern with rising crime rates throughout the 1980s. So not only in California, but across the country, other states, the federal government put in place a lot of these determinant sentencing. And then we see the prison population ballooning as a result of that. Initially, in the 1980s, California kind of kept up with that booming prison population and passed a lot of bonds to build new prisons. But in the last more than decade or so, we haven't been building new prisons. We run into this capacity issue. We have a lawsuit with the U.S. Supreme Court that the prisons are over capacity. And so Brown, in his second go-round, is trying to reverse a lot of those decisions. And this is just another one of those ways that he's trying to keep that prison population down and trying to do it in a way that is going to keep the most, violent offenders off the streets. That's been kind of talked about in the last decade or so up in Sacramento, of coming up with ways to keep the most serious offenders in jail and letting some of those other ones who are not as serious, the nonviolent, non-serious offenders, out into the community, help them transition so that they aren't threats to their community.
Now, so far, the governor's reforms have proven popular with voters. In 2012, California voters amended this three strikes law, changing that provision and essentially loosening the three strikes provisions. Then in 2014, Proposition 47 was approved, changing a lot of those felony drug and property offenses to misdemeanors. There, since then, though, you hear law enforcement out there saying that Prop 47 is to blame
for perceived spikes in crime. Some people will say it's too early to tell, or it's not a causal link between the two. That perhaps remains up in the air. Is it important to watch Prop 57, not only in the immediate terms of what it would do, but also to see where the winds are blowing in terms of the California electorate and their relative coolness or warmness to these sorts of criminal justice reform, some would say, experiments?
Yeah, no, I would say that, you know, given the couple of the propositions that you mentioned, that there is an appetite among voters to roll back these stiffer penalties for crimes. I mean, I think that indicates to me that there's a realization that the lock 'em up mentality, which is really what happened in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, lock 'em up and make those penalties as hard as you can, is not going to work, because eventually you run into the problem that we ran into with the overcapacity. This has kind of died down, but several years ago there was this concern that the amount of money that the state is spending on prisons versus universities, well, the amount of money spent on prisons is exceeding the amount on universities. I don't believe it's quite there. It depends on which pots of money you're looking at. But I think that was a real wake-up call for the California electorate, you know, to say that we're going to spend more on prisons than education. And so the electorate seems to be more open to rolling back these reforms, and Governor Brown has been a big advocate of them.
And we'll see how it plays out in November. There's two separate ballot measures dealing with the death penalty. Is that a potential source of confusion for voters?
You know, it's interesting because it is a common strategy among ballot measure advocates to put rival measures on there in an attempt to intentionally confuse voters and make them vote one way or another.
Do people just wind up voting no on everything at that point?
Not necessarily. You know, the research that has looked into this has said that voters use these shortcuts to figure out how to vote on these ballot measures. And there's one study that goes back in the early 1990s where California had six measures on the ballot dealing with auto insurance. You know, not exactly an exciting, real interesting topic. But what that study found is that voters paid attention to who was endorsing and opposing those measures. And they pay attention to those, and they can make the distinctions between what the ballot measures would do. So if they find someone or an organization that they like endorsing them, then they can make the link to that ballot measure and vote for it. So I would say just in general that voters are less confused than we might anticipate. And something like this, it's, you know, for or against, it's kind of a intuitive response to these measures.
Looking at some of the other things before voters and the big races that are garnering attention up and down the valley, one of them has to be the congressional seat currently held by David Valadao, Emilio Huerta, the son of UFW co-founder Dolores Huerta, someone with strong Kern County ties, is challenging the Republican incumbent who thus far has managed to fend off any efforts by Democrats to take a seat, which many feel should be theirs. How is Huerta doing on the financial side? And does that are there any signs there that this is going to be a competitive race this go around?
You know, I tend to be more pessimistic on this race. I don't think Huerta is going to come close to raising as much as Valadao. We go back to the primary election. Valadao had over $1 million+. In his bank account. Huerta, I think, had around 200,000 or so. I haven't seen the latest figures, but my feeling on this district is that it's pretty much, I don't want to say impossible, but the odds are really stacked up against Huerta in terms of taking out Valadao, especially when he's been winning race after race now. The Democrats are trying to throw candidates at him, and they just can't seem to knock him off. And basically, the longer that he's been in office, the more he gets reelected, the chances just go down of one of those Democrats knocking him off. So I think it's actually, it'll be interesting to see kind of going out into the future, how much, how long does the Democratic Party keep pumping money into this race to try and knock him off?
Well, that's my next question. Is the DCCC going to invest in that race heavily as one that could possibly be a swing district for them, a potential pickup? Do we have any tea leaves we can read
into
that?
I haven't seen anything, and we're still, you know, almost 2 months out. So a lot of times they'll wait longer in the race. They're looking across the country to see whether or not other races are closer and whether they can pick something up. And my guess is they're not going to put a lot into this race.
How unusual was it that you had Donald Trump coming to California in Tulare for a fundraiser event last week, the day before he wound up going to Mexico for this last-minute visit with the Mexican president, and then this big speech in about immigration in Arizona? California is not a state by any means, by almost any political observer, that has a chance of showing up in Trump's column come November. Rather unusual. What's going on there? I mean, he did raise a good bit of money from Valley Farmers.
Well, it's interesting. I've been looking at we have a lot of these websites now that make predictions and present percentages of chances of winning states. And I think the New York Times had Hillary with a 99% chance of winning. I mean, winning California. So
you're saying there's still a chance?
Yeah. There's that one out of 100% chance. Well, I think obviously he's coming here for money. It's no secret that California has big donors, and the San Joaquin Valley, the Central Valley, is obviously a strong conservative, Republican-leaning region. And we've seen this in the past with Romney and McCain. They'll come here to make money. I mean, I thought the interesting thing about this trip was that he had earlier made statements, I think, when he was in here, in the region in May, about California being in play, and he was going to make a strong push for California. And by him just coming in and just doing it basically a flyover fundraiser, I don't know if he was here like 2 hours. I think it was about an hour or so, with no campaign rallies at all. Obviously shows that he's not going to make a play for California. He's given up on it, and he's just trying to pull some money out of the state.
There's been made a lot nationally of Trump's lack of a traditional ground game, doing the sorts of things that the Republican Party would traditionally do and getting out the vote. What does that, combined with California being a safe state for Hillary Clinton and the Democrats' ground game, what does that mean for down-ballot, down-ticket races in November? Are we going to see big get-out-the-vote efforts in California from above, or how does that play with everything else that's going on with this stacked ballot that we have with all these propositions?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot going on here, and I think the thing to remember is that in presidential elections, we just get a natural jump in voter turnout of, say, 20 percentage points. I mean, if you go back and look historically in California at voter turnout in presidential elections, it always jumps. And that's when we've known that California has been a Democratic state going back to the Clinton administration. So we know there's going to be this natural big jump from the presidential election. And then beyond that, it helps if it's competitive. It's nationally, too, and it's not looking that competitive right now. But I would certainly say that it's one definite weakness for Trump, where he has not, through the primary season, he has not made much effort to try and help out candidates for the U.S. Senate, candidates for the House of Reps. So I think that those candidates are going to suffer. I would say that the Clinton campaign is making a much bigger effort. The other thing that you have going on here is that typically the presidential candidates will coordinate with the their respective parties, right? Hillary's campaign is going to coordinate with the Democrats, Trump with the Republicans. But we have this huge rift between Trump and the Republican Party, the Republican leadership. So I would imagine that that lack of coordination is only going to hurt down ballot races for Republicans. We're starting to see a lot of discussions about Republicans separating themselves from Trump as their strategy going into the general election.
Before we go, one last question on a hyper-local note. The Fresno mayor's race, we saw two endorsements last week. Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearengen endorsing Lee Brandt. Genuinely news, but maybe not shocking. Both of them Republicans. Brandt has been a big supporter of Swearengen's policies at City Hall as a member of the City Council. But Henry Perea, a very outspoken Democrat, a very outspoken liberal, getting the endorsement of perhaps the most conservative member, not only of the Fresno County Board of Supervisors, but maybe of any elected office in Central California, Debbie Poochygian, a staunch Republican, endorsing Perea. Eyebrow raiser? What's going on there?
I thought it was very surprising. I'm sure there's some backstory that we need to find out there, because that was... very surprising. If I remember correctly, they used to do a battle on the county board of soup. So,
yeah.
Quite surprising that she would come out. I would say, in terms of which endorsement's going to matter more, I would say the Swearengen one is probably going to matter more. No surprise there. I think kind of the more interesting question is, you mentioned the ballot measures, how is that going to increase turnout and so on. The thing you have to remember about the mayoral race is it's nonpartisan. So there are not party labels on the ballot for Perea or Brand. So anybody who's turning out is just a loyal Democrat, unless they have good name recognition of one of the candidates. It's not necessarily going to help you out as much as it would if they had those party labels there.
Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins joining us today, talking about the November election. It's growing closer, folks. It's almost here, for better or for worse. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
This is Valley Edition. Stay with us. In our next segment, we'll learn about a new exhibit at the Bakersfield Museum of Art and the new major field of study for some Fresno State students. That's coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. In an effort to connect Hmong college students with their heritage, Fresno State is now offering a minor in Hmong language studies. It's the first of its kind in the Western U.S. and only the fifth in the nation. FM89's Ezra David Romero recently sat down with the creator of the program, Dr. Cao Li Yang. She says more than 100 students have already signed up.
You've been working on this Hmong minor for multiple years, right? Tell me about how that process has unfolded.
The linguistic department wanted to have a minor. It was Dr. Jean Wang. She's a linguistic professor. She came out with the idea, and so she asked me to coordinate the Hmong program. And then from that, she asked me if I'm willing to work for the Hmong minor. So I reorganized all the curriculum and wrote 5 textbooks in 2 years.
Wow, five textbooks.
Yeah, for 5 classes. And this summer, I just finished, because in the Hmong language, you have 2 dialects, the White Hmong and the Green Hmong. And usually, we teach only White Hmong. And I, for the past years, I felt I need to do something for my Green Hmong student as well. So this summer, I finished with my colleagues, Dr. Cho Li, who's teaching with me as well, for the Hmong 1B, the second semester, a textbook in Green Hmong. And I can say this is the first textbook in the world in Green Hmong.
Wow.
A normal one with all the lesson, with the audio file, the lab, with the workbook.
Was it hard to make those 5 or 6 course books that you had to write yourself?
Oh, it was so challenging. I cannot say I almost died. It will be too childish. But it's almost like this. Because I want to make textbook like French or Spanish textbook. I also, because you have no place to go to learn how to teach Hmong, and I have to make those textbook teachable for people who don't know how to teach, people who know the language, who have the passion for teaching the culture, the language, but they don't know how to use pedagogy to teach, so I have to make those textbooks. I have to record hundreds and hundreds of files. So, for example, in most of my classes, the audio file, the lab exercises are in both dialect, White Hmong and Green Hmong, for example.
Wow.
Yes, and for the Hmong 4, 100, 101, I did not write all the text because I'm not enough knowledgeable. So I need to use a very diversified source of resources. So I asked a lot of people all over the world to allow me to use the textbook freely. So I make sure the textbooks are cheap. So, for example, for the minor, for 6 courses, students will be paying only about $150 textbook.
Are there other Hmong minors at other universities in the country?
Yes, you have 4 other in the Midwest, mainly. But the difference is here in Fresno, we have a minor focusing on language. And the 4 other is more topics. They use English to teach, and they have a few courses in Hmong language, but the focus is not on language learning.
So you're focusing on language. Does that mean you're going to teach the students in Hmong?
Yes. Most of the courses will be in Hmong language. You cannot only teach the skills. You have to teach a student to process in that language. Each culture, each language is different because in that culture, in that language, you have the different approach, cognitive skills. So I want my Hmong student not only to be able to speak the language, but to understand, to approach issue from the Hmong perspective. And for that, you have to speak the language.
Is it a requirement that you speak Hmong before you take these courses?
No, it was very funny. I have a student, he came to see me. He said, Madam, I need to take Hmong 1A. Hmong 1A, it's open to everyone, people who never took Hmong before and people who do not speak the language.
What are the courses these students are going to take? What are they going to learn?
We learn how to greet people, how to show politeness, how to address people, how to express emotion, how to cook, talk about cooking. And you go to Hmong 1B, so you learn other situation. For example, how to describe, how to give a direction in Hmong. And then you go to Hmong 4. Hmong 4 is the first semester where you are introduced to literature. So we learn a poem, but we write poem too. And something amazing about that Hmong 4 class, I learned from many parents that they gave a different name to that Hmong 4 class. They call it the Miss Hmong class because the activity, the skill I developed in the Hmong 4, it's very well to prepare people to participate to the beauty contest. It's amazing because I teach a student to do informational speech, how to write poem, how to sing, and those are the skills in order to be able to participate to a beauty contest.
Yeah, you're talking about the Miss Hmong beauty contest that happens every year,
yes,
right? During
every year.
Like January-ish,
yes.
Right?
And I happen to sponsor several of my students because I believe that you learn a language, you have to know how to use it. And so be able to go to participate to a contest, you're going to use your skills and show to your parents and the community that you know the language, you know how to behave appropriately.
Why do you think it's so important for this Hmong minor?
Oh, I came out with an idea. I don't know if it's related to Hmong minor or not, but in a sense of 2000 and 2010, the population, people under 24 years old, you have more than half, 50%. And I said to myself, we have such a small population, half are under 24 years old, and the people capable to lead the young people. Those people range of percent, it's only about 10 to 15%. So we have a few capable leaders or elderly or parents to take care of those children. So for the Central Valley, we need a Hmong minor to train leaders. Also to help The new leaders understand how to deal with the population, the young people.
So it's more than just a Hmong language minor. It's a way of training young people to become the next leaders in the Hmong community here.
Yes, I wish to have really to do that. I talk about reconnecting with a very long tradition of culture, because in that culture you have really good values as well.
How many students are enrolled so far in your courses?
Yes, right now we have about 120 students. I believe we're going to have about 50, 60 minors.
Pretend I'm one of your students, you know, walking into your class this semester for the first time. What are you going to teach them?
Politeness, for example. The first lesson we do is how to greet people. So to say hello, you say Nyo Zhong.
Nyo Zhong.
And you say welcome to my house. So you say Ka Tuo Lao.
Ka Tuo Lao.
Not too bad. But, and so, if you have someone, a brother or sister coming to how coming back home, you don't use ka tuo lao, you have to use ka la lao.
Ka la lao.
And so, but you have a guest, someone who is not a part of the family, so you say ka tuo lao. And so, to reply, you will use a second word, and the verbs, tuwa, tuwa is to come. So you reply, you said, Tuao.
Tuao.
So we can redo, Nyo Zhong Ka Tuo Lao.
Tuao.
Perfect.
Are we missing anything? Is there anything else you want to add about the Hmong studies minor?
Yes, I really want to send a message to parents to encourage their children to take Hmong. And I believe some of the students have a misconception about Hmong language. They believe that the language... they don't need it because they live in the United States, and I want to say to them that the language also is a professional tool, because we live in the Central Valley. We have a aging population, and some of them only speak Hmong. So as a nurse, as a social worker, as a doctor, as employees working for in relation with the Hmong community, they do need to speak the language in order to make their life easier. And the Hmong is not a difficult language. We use Latin. We don't have a specific writing systems. We use Latin, the alphabet Latin, so it makes the learning quite easy. I spent about 25 years of my life to do research on how to teach the correct pronunciations, how to teach grammar, basic skills. I am not only a linguist, but also an anthropologist specialized in the Hmong study for so many years. And I want to say that I have a lot to share. So I'm trying as a professional to teach languages.
I've been chatting with Dr. Cao Li Yang. She's a professor here at Fresno State. She created all the curriculum for the new Hmong Language Studies program. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This is Valley Edition. 2016 is a big year for the Bakersfield Museum of Art. It has a lot of big events coming. It's also the museum's 60th anniversary. Here to tell us some more about what's coming up, including new exhibits and the Driven by Art program, it's Shannon Medina joining us now, the marketing director for BMOA. Shannon, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Shannon, I want to get to Driven by Art in a moment, but you just opened some new exhibits. Tell us about this new exhibit featuring the works of Edward Reap. This is an artist with some strong, strong local ties. This is pretty exciting.
Yes, it's very exciting. We just opened this exhibit on September 1st, so it's only been open for a few days. There's actually two exhibits by him. There's one with 8 decades worth of his paintings. He's been painting since the 1930s, and he ended his very last painting was in 2003. So we're very excited to show all of these paintings, this very diverse group with all different kinds of, he has watercolor, oil, very different styles he experimented. You couldn't really pin him down. He didn't want to stick to just one thing.
Who was Edward Reap?
You know, he was a war artist. He was he's best known for watercolor. He lived in Bakersfield since the 80s, and he was actually even on the board of directors at the museum for quite a while.
And so you have the exhibit of the retrospective of his work, and then the other exhibit that deals with his career. What's that about?
Yes, this one is called Framing Edward Reap. It's a war artist's journey to Bologna. So just a few years ago, actually, his granddaughter found film that he had taken while he was a combat artist. And he had taken pictures from the Apennines into Bologna right before they were liberated and right after. So they just found these film slides in a cigar box in his garage, and they had them developed. And lo and behold, they have the first picture of what's called the shrine. It was the day after Bologna was liberated, and there was a wall where the Nazis and fascists would execute partisans. And so he was actually there when they started taking pictures of the loved ones that they had lost and putting them on this wall. And he had taken the first photograph of that, and he actually painted a picture of that.
When you say war artist, what does that refer to? Was he working on an official assignment as an illustrator or a photographer for a publication, or was he a combat soldier who was just doing art on the side? Tell us more about that.
No, he was actually officially the Army had selected him to be an artist and capture what was happening. So he was officially through the Army as a photographer and an artist. He was still would take part in the combat if needed, but he was also given free rein to go where he needed to take pictures and to capture what was happening at the time.
What's
an actual program.
A fascinating story and some incredible work that you can see now on exhibit at the Bakersfield Museum of Art. We're talking with Shannon Medina today about what's coming up at the museum. You also have this other big project that's been, months, if not years in the making, that's about to make its public debut. What is this Driven by Art program about? I saw on your Instagram just a moment ago that there is a picture of a pickup truck painted with all sorts of Bakersfield scenes. What is Driven by Art all about?
Driven by Art it's been in the works for 2 years, actually. So it's a public art project, kind of like Chicago's Cows on Parade, New York Big Apples. It's a way for us to really celebrate the community and our 60th anniversary. So we selected 33 artists to paint these about 4x6 foot fiberglass pickup trucks that are going to be all around the Bakersfield downtown. And each artist got to select how they wanted to paint it, and they come out in October. So they're not downtown yet, but you can, like you mentioned on Instagram, look up the hashtag BMOA Driven by Art and see the progress on many of the trucks.
This has to be a mammoth project, just literally dealing with the size of these objects and coordinating the artists. How does that work?
Definitely. Well, we didn't do it by ourselves. We had a group of very dedicated volunteers, you could say, that have been heading this up and leading it. So they've been instrumental in getting the funding and getting the truck designs and getting the trucks here and to the artists. It's been a project. So if anyone plans on taking one on, I say plan for a couple of years.
And then you have a special gala that celebrates this sort of a preview coming up in just a few weeks.
Yes. So the trucks will be at the museum for a couple of weeks. We're having a preview gala, which is also celebrating our 60th year. So you'll be able to see the trucks, take part in an auction, play casino games, have a dinner. It'll be a great affair.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to all of that. If people want more information about any of these things or want hours or other information, what can they do to reach you at the museum?
Mm-hmm. They can go to bmoa.org is our website. You can also follow us on Facebook at BMOA1930 and Instagram at TheBMOA.
Well, it sounds like a great way to celebrate 60 years of bringing great art to Kern County. Again, Shannon Medina, the marketing director for the Bakersfield Museum of Art, with new exhibits out, the work of Edward Reap, a talented local artist who's known throughout the nation and especially California, and also the new Driven by Art project that's coming to town in just a few weeks. Shannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to thank you for tuning in, and we'd love to know what you think. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet. We're at KVPR and at Valley Edition. You can also find our podcast and audio archives on our website at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.